Welcome to the GTC podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, guys. Okay, we've got a good one today. We have got a gent called Marley, as in Bob Marley. That's how he introduced his name to me. Spelt like the country, said like the singer. There you go. You can keep that one. Put that on your new t-shirt. And he's Aussie Frontline. Aussie Frontline is a bit of a unique brand or community, and we'll get into it a little bit more. We'll delve into it as we go, but it's from Australia. So without further ado, Marley, welcome, mate. How are you?
Thank you for having me, PJ. It's an absolute pleasure, mate.
Yeah, no, thank you for coming on, mate. We're slowly ticking off the Commonwealth at the moment. We've had some South African lads on, and we've got some Kiwis booked in, so it's good to have an Aussie on.
Yeah, absolutely, mate.
Perfect. Right, so let's get started then, mate. The reason that we sort of connected and we sort of found each other was me sort of browsing around on Instagram, and essentially I think most people realise right now that I'm down under, if you like, but I'm over in across the ditch in New Zealand currently. So I was looking around, seeing what the landscape is like for veteran-owned, service-owned companies, brands, things like that. And the one that kept popping up is yours, Aussie Frontline.
Who knows how the algorithm works, mate?
yeah. Either you were doing the right targeting advertising, or it was just looking at people that look the same. For those listening, it turns out that me and Marley have the same choice. I'm going to say choice in haircut, and although his is a bit longer. Yeah, I know,
that's
right?
That's generous. we do look similar. We could be brothers, and I mean, it's possible. Anything's possible.
It is true. It is true. One from the fire service, one from the police. It'd be arguments in the house. Let's put it that way.
There would be. Absolutely.
So tell us about Aussie Frontline, mate. Like, what is it, first of all? How would you describe it?
Good question. We're a company, we're a brand that is trying to make a positive difference in the frontline / military / veteran community. So I sound like a bit of a wanker when I say that, because there's a lot of companies, charities, organizations that are preaching that they're trying to do something good for the that demographic, but ultimately we're legitimately trying to put something back in, add or improve culture, improve morale, improve support for men and women in those services, in those frontline services or military or having left any of those. And we do that through at the moment the Instagram page and the shirts we sell, the meaning behind the shirts, what we do with the money, and the kind of content that we post and whatnot. So that's probably the concise version. Obviously there's a lot of wings to it, and we can go off in a lot of different directions, but in a couple of sentences, that's what we would be, mate.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, we intend to go on those tangents, so we won't spoil the rest of this podcast in the first 30 seconds, eh?
Good idea.
Yeah, I know. Someone's got to drag this out for my mum to listen. So it's interesting that, mate, because obviously most of the people that we've had on, most guests, especially ones that run and own businesses, veteran-owned, service-owned sort of thing, are from the UK space. You know, it's from where we're from, and that's sort of where we're coming from. So it's very interesting to talk to someone outside of that area that's doing the same sort of thing, spreading the same sort of message, in a very similar culture, but also a very different culture in the same way. And what I wanted to know what is the vibe like at the moment within services and mills in Australia? What is the sort of underlying tone? Is there a great need for this kind of morale boost and this kind of like support from more of a brand type perspective? Or is it relatively balanced and it's just sort of making sure that we're where we should be in terms of helping each other out?
Yeah, good question, mate. I think, I mean, I can't speak for any service other than the police, and even within the police, I can only speak from my experience in my state, in my area. But having started this journey with Aussie Frontline and I guess engaging with heaps of different people around the country from the various services and hearing their messages and hearing what's going on for them and what the current issues are for them, it would seem as though, you know, what I'm seeing and with my own eyes and listening to with my own ears is very much the case for, I don't know, the majority. Like I'm only ever finding common ground with people. It's never the opposite. And I guess from my perspective, I think I've been in the cops for just over 14 years, and compared to some, that's not long. Compared to some, that is long. But even in my time, I have seen a decrease in what I would consider positive culture, and a decrease in general morale, a decrease in general positivity, like people being proud of what they're doing and showing up to work having a sense of pride in what they do, and then when you have a sense of pride in what you do, that sort of flows on to other people. We all know what it's like to be around a group of really positive, encouraging people versus a group of toxic, negative, pessimistic people. So the culture's gone backwards in my eyes, and then that flows down to people just being relatively unhappy at work a lot of the time. Can't speak for everyone, I guess over the last year or just prior to starting Aussie Frontline, there's obviously a number of reasons that motivated me to do that, but it's going, you know what, like the job is still the same. It's changed. The way we do it has changed, but ultimately, policing, from my perspective, policing is still policing. It's been like that for a long time. The parts of the job that were good a long time ago, some of them are gone, some of them are still there. But the culture is what's really fading away. And, workplace culture, you spend 40 hours a week if you're lucky and don't get overtime, you spend 40 hours a week in that culture. If that culture is toxic and negative, then what is the impact that has on your mental health? If all the other pressures you're experiencing outside of work are enough to take you close to the edge and fill your cup, then you go to work and you're in a toxic culture. There's a lot to be said for the benefit of having a really positive, encouraging culture in the workplace, in general, any workplace. It just so happens that I'm in an emergency services role, and so that's where I'm focusing my energy.
Yeah, 100%, mate. I think you hit the sort of nail on the head in a couple of sort of aspects there. I think the whole filling your cup up analogy is a very good one. You know, you've only got so much bandwidth. You know, people can only deal with so much at any one time. And with modern pressures being the way they are, especially straight after COVID, inflation, economy, life, it's all sort of boiling over. If you want to get in even deeper into sort of identity, sexuality, gender, all that kind of layers of that as well, it's a very confusing time to be alive. And I think if you then add that complication to the fact that you live a high risk life in your job, which is either a danger to yourself or other people, it's even more accelerated. You know, a lot of people have stresses in their life and a lot of people have stuff they need to deal with 100%, no matter what service, job, career they follow. But a lot of those don't have life and death consequences. Whereas the guys and girls on the front line, it is life and death. You know, whether it's ambo, whether it's fire, whether it's military, whether it's police. Notice I did police last. It is a risk. and things do happen and people get hurt. Both, you know, the people that shouldn't get hurt, the people that arguably deserve getting hurt, you know, people get hurt. And I think it's an important thing to remember that it is a job, but it's a job that affects your life. Whereas a lot of other jobs, you turn up, you go home, what's really going to change? Even if you lose that job, nothing's really going to change. Whereas, you know, you can lose the job, but the job can lose you. If that makes sense, you know, a lot of services, the job can lose you and ticks on. Whereas a lot of other normal jobs, you can lose the job and you've still got yourself. So it's important to keep going, mate. And I love the message, hence why I sort of reached out and started this conversation. And it's good to get you on and get that perspective. That that whole switch, that whole change, this is quite a sort of a difficult question probably for anyone to answer. That whole change and that sort of difference in the perception of the services currently, do you reckon that's more government-led in terms of the establishment and how it's been governed and run and funded? Or do you think it's more public perception in how the public's seeing those roles, whether that's been distorted and twisted by anything? But is it more public-led or more government and institution-led, or are you not really sure?
Yeah, good question.
I know, mate. We're 11 minutes in, and I'm fitting you with that.
Jesus. No, it's a fair question. I'm going to be, throughout this podcast, I'm going to be intentionally careful with how I answer the questions, because I'm still a police officer.
Yeah, 100%, mate.
You know, my – yeah, I don't need to explain that any further. So I think – I'm going to say I don't think it's public's perception. I don't think that really bears a lot of or doesn't deserve the majority of the responsibility for, I guess, the way as a whole, you know, staff view their job and view their role and you know, exist within that role and within the people in it. I definitely think that it's flowed downhill from organizational change. Obviously the needs from police have changed as technology has changed and as the public's expectation has changed. So there's just been a lot of changes. I mean, I don't have a graph, but I assume if everything was graphed, there would be a massive trajectory upwards in terms of change over time, which requires adaption. You know, the majority of what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing is just understaffed. And understaffed results in overworked and chronically stressed is the short answer. The stuff that we do, as you know, it's a stressful job. And, you know, that chronic stress from being exposed to, you know, trauma and stressful environments constantly, that chronic stress, you know, there's once you are expected to do more with the same amount of time without really having anything else to reduce what's in that cup, I mean, how could you not have people that become more and more stressed? And then, you know, stress is a disease. Stress leads on to mental health. It leads on to physical health. It leads on to emotional health. Like, you know, the big one that I see is really staffing. And then what causes staffing? You know, like, I know the police force would love to be fully staffed, so I'm not blaming them. Where who does the buck stop with? How far do you trace it back? Why is it happening? You know,
I think it was a bit of a trick question. I'll give you that. Like, it at the end of the day, you know, it all comes down to funding, and all these services are funded by the public, and the decisions of how much funding gets given is done by government. Government's arguably responsible to the public, but are they? But are they not? You know, it's a full circle. Absolutely. But it's interesting to get the perspective of Australia, you know, and see. Obviously, I say the perspective of Australia. You can't get a whole country's perspective off one geezer, but you know,
especially a bald geezer.
Yeah, especially one with an upside down head. Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. I mean, it is very interesting though, hearing the parallels. You know, the attitude towards services in Australia seems very similar to the UK at the moment. The public perception seems to remain relatively strong. The people that don't think we need XYZ will always think we don't need it. And the people that think we do will always think they need we do. The funding will peak and trough as and when natural things happen. You know, as soon as the London 2012 terror attacks happened, you know, funding went through the roof for counterterrorism policing in the UK, ridiculous amounts. It also went through the roof for urban search and rescue for fire services, you know, and it just went through the roof. They were throwing money at the wall. A few years later, trickling off, trickling off, trickling off, and now it's almost non-existent. You know, we're in Essex County Fire and Rescue. They're chinning off their urban search and rescue department. It's going, it's disappearing. It was initially founded because of, you know, being close, so close to London, could be utilized in an urban search and rescue environment, especially after a terrorist attack. It wasn't utilized in the way that it was meant because we didn't get any major terrorist attacks, thanks to intelligence services. And now they're defunding it to the point now it's being disbanded. And it comes down to, it's interesting just to see that the parallels are very similar. You know, in a country that is very similar to the UK, just, you know, the other way up.
I'm not surprised to hear you say that. And I dare say the issues are ultimately very similar. But, you know, that's where Aussie Frontline comes in, because, you know, we can't control that. You know, an effort, you know, direct your effort where you can control. You know, we can't control the funding, but we can control how we turn up to work, how we support each other, how we interact with our colleagues and our friends, you know, how we show up when someone's clearly not doing so well. They're all things we can control. So that's where I'm trying to put my energy.
Yeah, I think that's smart, mate. You know, control the controllable, forget the rest. So when did Aussie Frontline start? You know, when was it founded, and when did you start sort of trying to make this difference, really?
So it's only been, so the first and only thing I've done is the Instagram page. Everything's run through there. So it's I've described it to others as like a bit of an organic process. So back in 2017, I designed the emblem. So the emblem, as you would have seen, represents Army, Air Force, Navy, Police, Fire, EMBOs. And it takes a piece of the insignia from each of those services insignia and combines them together. I designed it not for this purpose. I designed it for a tattoo studio back in 2017. So for quite some years, I've tattooed. I don't anymore because I've let it lapse, but I've had secondary employment approval from the police as a tattooist. And once upon a time, I wanted to open a tattoo studio called Frontline Tattoo, which was the same sort of principle, I guess, but not from a mental health angle, from a tattoo angle. So, you know, constantly hearing coppers go, where can I go and get tattooed that's not owned by a bikie? So I was like, you know what? I'll just open one and I'll tell everyone where it is. So I designed the emblem for that purpose. And then for a number of reasons that didn't eventuate and I stayed in the police. And so it just sat there for years, but I just really loved it. And I always wanted to do something with it. Like, I just didn't know what it was. And it was late 2021 where I was like, you know what, I'd love to put that on a shirt, you know, throw the flag on there, throw that on there. And initially I thought that's what a really cool way to be able to walk around and, you know, represent your chosen organization, or, you know, for many people they've worked in multiple, but to represent it, but without actually spelling out which one you're in. So it started off as you know, if you know, you know, but if you don't know, you're not sure. So like you walk into a cafe, you see someone else wearing it, you know, they're in something, and you know, if something goes down, they're probably going to help you, but you don't know what they're in. And if anything, it'll spark a conversation and you meet someone new and you have a chat and like good as gold. And that's how it started.
Classic coppers, that is. That's coppers pretending so that other people think they're firefighters. That's what that is, I tell you.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I had a boys' night away with two of my best mates and we were sitting around. I was like, fuck, I'd love to put this on a shirt. Let's do it. And they're like, yeah, fucking, I'll wear it. I was like, cool, it's good enough for me. So I went and got a bunch made. I've also got a little side business, which is filming, and I had a website and an e-commerce platform for video work. But I didn't have one for Aussie Frontline. So I was like, I'll just throw the shirts on my videography website, link it to Instagram, and I'll just start sort of preaching what's important to me. And it just grew from there. So right now it's very different to how it started, but that's how it started. And that was, I reckon the first post went out probably almost spot on a year ago. So we're talking 12 months.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, obviously, I've only seen it in the past couple of months, really, and then been tracking it a little bit before I reached out. So, but it's pretty cool. It's an awesome concept. You know, in the UK, there's a full-on movement currently from veteran-owned companies and service-owned companies starting up and doing things. But I haven't yet seen one with the sort of a combined forces, if you like, logo. And it's a great logo. Like, it's done really well. It's very clean, especially on. Ah, oh, nice. He's showing me a tattoo on his hand with it on as well. That is sick, to be fair. That is sick. And then on the background of the on the flag as well. That's a lovely touch. You know, yeah, it's very cool. And I think it's a good subtle branding that, you know, even if you're just supporting those forces or those services, it can still be worn, because you're not overly like saying, oh, I am this, I am that. It's like, oh, there's all those different emblems on there. And you, when you look at them, you can see them and go, oh, that's that, that's that, that's that. It's relatively obvious. But it's not overly saying, I'm this, I'm that, which is a very clever way of doing it. Because as you say, people that are just supporting the brand and not from those services individually can go on and say, you know, and have it and wear it, and not have to feel. There's a big thing, I don't know if it's big in Australia, but it's big in the US, obviously, like, and, you know, stolen valor, the idea of stolen valor. Yeah. And then in the UK, it's called a Walter Mitty. And there's whole sort of, he was a famous guy that acted. There's a whole sort of movement called the Walter Mitty Hunting Club. And it's hilarious. The internet's fantastic. And they pull out people and ridicule them for pretending something they're not. But the point is that logo is done in a way where it's not pretending you're anything, and anyone can sort of represent it if they support it.
Absolutely. 100%, mate. It's not a club. You know, it's not an elitist club. It's literally just representative of those jobs and the men and women in those jobs. And we've got heaps of people that have bought shirts that aren't any of those, but for their own reasons, they all have an affection for, you know, maybe one or more of the services. It might have been a partner. Like, we've all got, you know, I shouldn't say we've all got partners, we don't all have partners, but, you know, many people in those jobs have partners who are not in those jobs, or brothers or sisters or mothers or fathers, and by default those people have often lived through some of the challenges that job has brought, you know. And some will tell tales that are of great things, and some very sad, you know. But the jobs, those jobs in particular, have far-reaching tentacles well beyond just the person that's employed. So there's many reasons why someone that's not in those jobs or hasn't been in those jobs would wear that shirt. But it happens regularly, and I support it 100%. You know.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the reasons that I designed GTC's logo the way it is, and the different logos that we use to represent GTC is for that very reason. You know, it's not an exclusive brand, and it's an inclusive brand. You know, yes, it's born out of service and it's tested operationally. That's our little tagline. But it's not just for people that have served or are serving. I think it's important, you know, just because you have served or been in a public service, retired from or currently serve, doesn't make you any better than anyone else. It's a job you chose, and it's, you know, it's a testament to your character that you did choose it. 100% agree, but it doesn't make you better than someone that works at, you know, Tesco, which is, you know, our equivalent of Countdown or Woolies, you know, Woolworths. So it's all the same sort of thing. I do want to pick up on something, right? This is quite an interesting one. I've followed it probably closer than most, but you mentioned bikies. Now, obviously, I know what sort of work you do at the moment. You have to be relatively careful about accusing certain groups of certain activities without the proper evidence. However, are all bikies criminals? No, I'm only joking. Don't answer that. So it's a very interesting one. Obviously, in the UK, we do have motorcycle clubs. One of the biggest being Hells Angels. One of the other biggest being Outlaws. And there's a bit of a rivalry. Every few years or so, one or the other gets stabbed or run off the road or attacked. But mostly, it's not really seen and heard of. You know, bikies in the UK are either not fully targeted or they're not the main criminal organized enterprise. When you look at a lot of the information coming out of Australia and New Zealand, they are the main organized criminal groups. Whereas in the UK, it's more traditional in the sense of localized area gangs, if that makes sense. Mm. So if you're from a certain area, you represent certain area, and then you may have what we call county lines. So county lines are running out of London to the home counties around London. And it's the lines of transport of delivering and supplying the certain things. So the question around that is bikies, is that the biggest generalized sort of I'm trying to be as careful as possible here, organized crime issue in Australia, or is there a bit of a mixture?
Oh, I'll probably answer that by saying there's a mixture, of course. There are, you know, a significant issue, but so is many others. I wouldn't be inclined to suggest that they're responsible for most or all or whatnot, but they're here, they're prevalent, they always have been, they probably always will be. Because of the laws we have, I don't know what laws you have over there, but the laws that have changed over the last 5 to 10 years in South Australia, so they become, you know, we don't overtly see them as much. In some circumstances, it's become illegal for them to congregate. And because of that, we just don't see it as much. But that doesn't mean it's not going on. So,
yeah, that's an interesting one. One of your, so essentially a friend of mine who serves in some capacity, I'm going to leave it at that, is a member of the Outlaws in England. And obviously in the UK, they can wear patches whenever they want, wherever they want, however many of them are collected together. That's not the case over in Australia, is it? That's changed relatively recently.
Yeah, that's right. So at the moment, unless it's changed since I worked in that area, it's three or more is illegal in public in colours. So, and that's just, you know, the biggest influence that has is minimising their movements to the public eye. So it doesn't change their movement. It doesn't change their movements. They carry on doing what they're doing like everyone else. The police carry on doing what they're doing. People that choose to be in those groups carry on doing what they're doing. But, you know, it's not as visible to Joe Blow down the street. Mum or dad, you know, used to go to the, you know, down to one of the popular bars on a Friday, Saturday night and see big groups. And that just doesn't happen anymore. So it probably seems like, you know, that's the good work of the police, maybe, I don't know, but it's just more underground.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, but it's also interesting here that most of your tattoo shops are owned by bikies, just like ours are owned by most bikers.
Look, it's a perception that's been around for a long time. It's very easy to own something without anyone knowing that you're actually the owner. So we can only go by the vibe that's been around for a long time, and I don't have the data on that, so don't quote me. But
you're so cagey, mate. Have a beer and start spilling the beans, right? So one of the things that I mainly noticed about Aussie Frontline that I was really interested in, and it's something that GTC is bringing their own adaption of to the UK, is the Pay It Forward scheme. Yeah, so try and explain it, mate. Try and explain the pay it forward scheme. Bear in mind that when we bring it out, there will be slight changes on it, but the whole sort of method of sponsor to candidate and then, you know, someone recommended, that's all the same sort of thing. So yeah, if you can just sort of explain that, because I think it's a great scheme and I've stolen the idea fully off you, so I want to give you full credit for it. So yeah, fire away, mate, the pay it forward scheme.
Yeah, I love how you've said the word scheme 7 times. It's not a scheme.
Yeah, it sounds like a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it's a pyramid. So I'm hoping you'll work for me one day. No, so it's when I mentioned earlier about the Aussie Frontline has a number of tentacles and how they go about trying to improve community and morale and support. This is one of them, obviously, and you picked up on that. So the system is we have three people involved in the process of pay it forward. One is a sponsor, one is a nominator, and one is a recipient. So the sponsor can be anyone. That person is the person responsible for purchasing what we call a pay it forward shirt. So it's the same shirt, Aussie Frontline shirt, but we're not sending it out to the person that paid for it like we would with anyone else that bought a shirt. When they purchase one of these pay it forward shirts, we bank it. So we set that transaction aside. And we've got a spreadsheet for all this. So we pop the sponsor's details in, and we set a shirt aside, and that ticks along in the background. So that's coming from people that have seen, and we'll obviously get into this. Why would they want to do that? I'll explain that. But ultimately, they're people that want to do something good for someone else. And there's a lot of people like that out there, but there's not always a lot of opportunities to do that in a meaningful way. And you know, anyone that's done it will probably tell you that that it felt really nice to be able to help someone that they didn't know. And you know, giving is an extremely important part of being in a community. You can't just take. In fact, if you just take, you're probably not welcome here.
Yeah, definitely, mate.
And So we got a sponsor. They buy the shirt. We bank those. Once we get up to sort of like 15 or thereabouts that have been sponsored, then we put a call out on Instagram for nominators. So we do that by saying we're running a pay it forward. If you know anyone who's struggling, be it in work, personal life, professional life, you know, in any way, if they're struggling at the moment and you know that, then you know, nominate them and we'll send them a shirt from us. And we'll pop a note in there, just try and pump them up a bit, and it'll arrive on their doorstep as a surprise. They'll open it, and the idea being that they will feel a sense of support that they didn't feel 5 minutes before that package arrived. And so our nominators are nominating all sorts. They're nominating colleagues that they've worked with, that they know are struggling with their mental health or with their physical health. So, you know, some have been disciplined by the organisation and they've been treated in their eyes unfairly, and that's playing a role in their mental health. Some are terminally sick. Some have, you know, lost children, lost parents, lost brothers. There's a whole myriad of reasons why someone would nominate them. And they don't have to be that big either. Some can be just years and years of being in the grind in a frontline role, and it's just clearly they're just chronically stressed all the time, you know, and don't feel overly supported by, you know, the organisation that they're working in. So, yeah, we canvass the community. We get a bunch of nominations. Nature of the beast is such that sometimes that nomination, you know, if we've got 15 shirts, we might get 10 people nominate, or we might get 25 people nominate. Never matches up.
Yeah.
So if less people choose to nominate than the amount of shirts we have, then we're good as gold. Just means we've got some left over for the next round. Mm-hmm. If we get more, then what I'll do is I'll put a second call out to say, look, we've had 6 nominations. We've only got this many shirts. Does anyone else want to step up and try and cover those last ones? And generally, there will always be people that will step forward because they don't want people to miss out. And you know, they don't like the idea of someone going, I know this person that needs support. I could be the reason that they got that support. but I'm not going to. It rarely happens. These days, we tend to fulfill it if it goes over. I always give the nominator the chance to provide a personal message from them or to remain anonymous. And it's probably 50-50. 50% of the time, they'll write a really meaningful note that I'll include in the so that the person that receives it knows exactly who's responsible for sending it. And the other half of the time, they just leave it up to me. So I'll write them something from Aussie Frontline. You know, obviously, it's not going to be specific to their circumstance because I don't know it, nor should I. But enough for them to know that, look, there's a community here that's behind you. And the feedback from that is unlike anything I could have ever imagined when this started. You know, we all know it's just a shirt. A shirt's not going to change anyone's world. It's not going to solve anyone's problems. Yet I'm told that, you know, by one person I can think of right now said that shirt arriving saved his life that day because he decided that he'd had enough. And just the intervention, unplanned intervention at that particular moment on that day was enough for him not to carry through with whatever it is he planned on doing that day.
I fully believe it. I've got a mate of mine who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago now. It is a very similar story in terms of we're just chatting about something and this sort of stuff come up. And he said, you know, one question saved my life. And I was like, what do you mean, mate? And he went, one question saved my life. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He was like, well, a couple of weeks ago, you know, I was having a rough time. And it sort of built. And literally one of the lads hadn't spoke to him in another bootneck in months, years, whatever, decided to reach out. So he gave me a text and he said, mate, I haven't spoke to you in a while. How are you getting on? And he replied saying, yeah, I'm all right. Then he replied saying, all right, yeah, what you been up to? Three or four messages later, that's always the usual response, isn't it? Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah,
100%. Three or four messages later, they're on the phone to each other. And, you know, that phone conversation saved his life. And, you know, he's alive now. And it's that kind of the smallest act is usually what makes the biggest difference. You know, and
absolutely, yep.
A t-shirt turning up, and I think what's very powerful about it as well, about t-shirt turning up from a company like yours or a brand like yours, Aussie Frontline, is that it represents a community.
Yep.
Someone you don't know might be your neighbor, might be someone you work every single day with, but they don't know, you don't know, or they might know, you might know. You know, it's a community that is helping each other no matter what, because that brotherhood, that sisterhood, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're in the police, if you are, sorry for your loss. It doesn't matter if you're in the fire service, the AMBO, the Air Force, the Navy, the Coast Guard, whatever it is, you know, surf lifesaving, whatever you're in that's helping people, there is a community around you that wants to support you do that. And you might not know it in your darkest times, but there are people out there that want to help and want to support. And I think it's an incredible scheme. And that's why we're still in it and trying to bring into the UK.
I'm absolutely honoured that you reached out to ask about it. There's more than enough ideas and kindness to go around. Like if you can take it and help people there, mate, be my bloody guest and I'll help you in any way I can. Absolutely. So I don't apologise for nothing.
Yeah, mega appreciate it, mate. Well, I think it's a cracking scheme. It really helps some people.
Just don't call it a scheme over there, mate.
I'm kidding, mate. Pyramid in front of it. but yeah, no, it's cracking. I've already ordered the leaflets explaining it all, so that's on the way to our distributor. I think that's our issue is that we're going to have to lack that personal touch that you've got in there. You've got a lovely personal touch, which is your message or their message. But just because of the scale that we're at and the fact that obviously I'm traveling, I'm away, our main distributor goes through a distributor. So they haven't got the capacity to hand write notes. It just is what it is. So I've mass produced something that explains it, and the system's going to be changed very slightly to allow for it. But I'll run you through that off air
cool.
in a couple of days or something, just so you can sort of be aware of it. But yeah, awesome, man. So what, looking forward, what's your aims, visions, hopes for Aussie Frontline? Where do you want it to go? Where do you see it being? What's the outlook? What's the plan?
The outlook is to be a positive influence in that demographic for as many as possible and as much as possible. So that's in a nutshell the aim. The aim is to support as many people as we can and help as many people as we can. And the method of doing that is obviously going to change as scaling occurs and as growth occurs. As you said just then, at the moment, albeit it takes up all of my time that I'm not at work or sleeping, I can not only put personal messages, like actually write personal messages for these people, but I'm also acting as a conduit between nominators and sponsors and whatnot, which is very time consuming. So part of that letter that a recipient would get actually lets them know from what service the shirt was purchased. So I don't obviously name anyone because people need their anonymity, but like if someone from, I don't know, someone based in New South Wales that was in the Army is the sponsor, well, I'll say that. I won't tell them who it is, but they'll know that it came from Army. So they might be a fiery and I've never interacted with anyone from the Army before, but they know that this shirt's come from someone in the Army. So, that level of, personalization is going to be difficult to maintain as it grows. So, things will change, but ultimately the goal will remain the same. The way that we'll do it, we'll have to change as we grow. We've currently developing a website. I have, as I said before, a side business with filming and video work and stuff like that. So I hope to include that at some point, which would be some content. So beyond the T-shirts and the pay it forward that are benefiting people, and I guess culture, which is invisible, but it's real. I'll probably introduce some content in some form to hopefully also be of some benefit and be able to help some people as well. And the beauty about that is it will be able to be accessed, whether I'm available or not, and by as many people that want it.
Like a sort of a passive sort of way to make an impact, so it can be sort of there when people need it rather than always needing to supply it.
Yeah, so producing content that might be on specific topics that we all struggle with, we all face. It's not doing anything that anyone hasn't done before. It's just like everything, trying to do it in a way that is, I guess, more engaging and connecting for that demographic, because there's plenty of stuff out there. No one's reinventing the wheel. We're all culture and being good to one another and supporting each other. And, these are not new concepts. These are concepts that have been around long before you and I were born, but people, we still need to work on them and we're still not doing them great. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So,
And how effective you are in that space depends on how you deliver it and who you are and what your reach is and how you choose to interact with those people. So it's about developing that to be the most effective that it can be, not trying to be something new or different.
Yeah, better believe it, mate. Like it's an interesting concept because scaling up and adapting and as you say, trying to be something in that space is very difficult at the moment. I mean, I don't know what the scene's like in the in Australia, but the veteran owned service sort of scene in terms of apparel, coffee companies, that sort of thing, it is exploding in the UK. Only for the better. I can off the top of my head name probably about 15 very decent veteran-owned companies, most of them former Royal Marines, but bias and all that. There's loads out there. We're still miles behind the US, but we are improving and we're getting better, and the whole culture and the support for veteran-owned brands and businesses is growing. What is it like in Australia? Is it sort of a big thing? Is there lots of veteran-owned and service-owned companies? Were you one of sort of the first that you noticed doing this sort of brand apparel thing? Or
Fair question. I'm going to say up front, like, my exposure to, you know, veteran owned businesses has literally only occurred since being in this space. So we're talking 12 months. So, you know, I don't come from a military background, but having had a social media presence and engaging with those people, like, it seems like it's fairly popular, and it seems like its popularity is growing, or there's more of them. And look, there's been some pop up that have really taken advantage of that. I'm thinking of one in particular, and anyone listening that's been around on social media will probably know who I'm thinking of, but, you know, really using that to their advantage from a monetary perspective until they got caught out. And, you know, that clearly is going to go on. But there's also a lot that are doing really good stuff and pushing out really important messages and, you know, really helping. There's one, for example, there's a coffee company based here that saw what we were doing as well. And they already had relationships helping other organisations and helping in this space. But they reached out and said, look, we'd love to do a blend of coffee, and the profits from that blend we'll send back to your counselling pool, which we can talk about because we haven't talked about that, if you want to. So every now and then they just shoot over some funds, which I put into the counselling pool, and we do good work with that money, you know. So there's a lot out there doing good things and pushing good messages. So, yeah, I can't knock that. That's fantastic. I don't know if I'm the first or the last or the middle. I've got no idea, mate. I'm just crack on doing what I think is right, and it sits where it sits.
Yeah, I love that, mate. It's a cracking attitude, you know. It's focus on your own space, control your own space, and do the best with it. You know, whatever happens around you is what's happening around you, innit? So I like that. Yeah, so I mean, I saw on your social media this counselling pool, and it is actually written, you know, on one of the things that I wanted to chat about. So there's a company in the UK called In the Dead Ground, and it's sort of a military term, and I don't think he listens to this, but I'm going to message him afterwards and make sure he does, because he's got a free shout out. And it's a case called Danny that runs it. And the idea is they sort of, they're a normal apparel company, but they donate and also lead into mental health and organize mental health sort of treatments, workshops, help, counseling, whatever you want to call it. So they're sort of intertwined in both sort of an apparel space and a sort of mental charity type space and helping people, and it's a military term, in the dead ground, which is like the ground that's not viewed as part of the battle space. So it'll be an area that you can't, you know, it's covered from view, covered from fire, it's the dead space, it's safe to move in effectively. So it's like the unseen, the unheard of, the unsort of looked after, if you like, that sort of space. But anyway, it's quite cool branding. But yeah, in the dead ground, yeah, and they do,
I like it,
a thing where they have sort of counselling type things. And that's what sort of reminded me of when I looked at this or saw your counselling pool. But what is that? Is that just like a fund that you then throw back out, or how does it sort of all match up?
Yep. So it's pretty simple. Every shirt we sell, $10 goes into that pool. And then from that pool, we fund counselling sessions for members of our frontline community. So, that's as we sell shirts, that kitty just gets bigger, and then we just give away sessions. So I guess the important part there is my we I don't know what it's like over there, but we have, you know, employee assistance sections. Like, if you're struggling and you approach the organization and say, look, I'm struggling, you know, internally they can supply you with X number of site appointments and cover up to however many sessions. You can do that through the GP. Like, we know those things are there, which is when I say we're not reinventing the wheel, like, they're there, but it's about how effective they are. People, the culture is such that people don't want to go into the police headquarters and say, I'm struggling. You know, I'm not sleeping, I'm doing this, I'm jacked up on caffeine or alcohol or whatever to cope. They don't want to go in and say that because they don't want to lose their job. For many of these people, their job is the one thing that's keeping them together. But it doesn't mean they're coping. And they're fearful that they will be removed from their team and, you know, possibly made non-operational and put somewhere for their own safety. And, you know, that, of course, there's an argument for that if it's required, but there's, you know, their team, their space, their friends, their colleagues, that might be the only thing that's kept them alive so far. So then you go and take that away to try and help, and ultimately you might kill them. So it's really difficult, which is why you have so many people that are struggling that don't tell anyone. You know, I'll just keep dealing with this myself because I've been dealing with this myself for a long time. I guess they can't always see that might be why everything's slowly falling apart for them. And there's only one way that's going to go if they keep going. So what we're trying to do is say, look, we're not the organisation. We're not a GP. We're none of that. From Aussie Frontline, I can hook you up with a person. This is his name. This is who he is. I'll pay for 3 sessions and all you got to do is show up, you know, see how it goes for you. If it doesn't work for you, take it, you know, leave it. If it works for you, then great. I'm so pleased for you. And this person is not only one of my best mates, I would consider him a brother to me. He's an ex-police officer. He's now a counsellor, accredited counsellor. He works only in this space. So he works for MESHA, which is Military and Emergency Services Health Australia. So he works full-time in this space, but he's also a counsellor, runs his own business. So he's got the experience from being in the job. He's been through hell and back himself. Everyone's got a story, and we're not here to compare anyone's story. But he and he won't mind me saying this, but he was extremely depressed and suicidal. He ultimately got arrested for some decisions he made at work. He got arrested whilst at work in uniform. He got taken to the cells where he'd been putting people for the last 10 years. He was suspended, fired, convicted, and wasn't able to get a gig at his daughter's school helping out to try and keep himself sane because of his conviction after having served his community. You know, all those decisions he made, he takes responsibility for, but they all happened at a time when he was clinging on, and one of those people I just described that hadn't reached out at that point. So he's been there. He's now working full time in this space, helping that very demographic that he worked with and is so passionate about. So I will connect them with him. It's not take this money and go find your own. It's I will pay for you to see this bloke. If you don't want to see him, that's fine. But if you do, I'll pay for it. And we've just had really, really good feedback from the people that have seen him. And he's helped me multiple times over the years, you know, for the struggles that I've had. So that's how it works. It's very personal. It's not, which I think is the key. You know, it's also scary. It's very confronting for people to stick their hand up. And that's a whole nother conversation. Trying to get people to actually put their hand up and go, actually, I would like to accept that. And I would like to go and see it. That's really bloody hard. But when they do, if they can do that, and the ones that have done that, it's from what I understand, it's only been positive, which is great. So that's the pool, and that's what we use it for. Yeah,
that's incredible, mate. As you say, I love the personalization of it. You know, you've got a connection with a bloke that knows what he's doing, knows what he's talking about. And it's almost one of those things of like, you know, you've vetted it all. You know, it's all vetted, it's all personalized. It's like, look, we know this guy, we know he helps people, he's helped me. Here's the guy. You've got 3 sessions, crack on. You know, it might help, might not, but you gotta give it a go, in you.
100%. And I should say his name's Matt Newland. So if anyone's listening and interested, you go follow Matty Newland. I know him inside and out. So like, you know, I guess people have a decision when they see what Aussie Frontline's doing. They have a decision to either listen to me or not listen to me, or whatever. My opinion's, what is it? It's just one bloke's opinion. But, you know, I vouch for him, and I know that he he's a wonderful human being, and that's why I'm happy to direct people his way. You know, and he's really committed to this. So there's been occasions where more people have stuck their hand up than what we actually had funding for. So at that point, he has two options. He says, sure, I can only take this many. I can't take the others because you don't have the funds. Or he can go, I'm really passionate about this demographic. I'll cover the one or two that you don't have the funds for. I don't want them to miss out. And that's what's happened.
That's amazing. Yeah. Top bloke. Yeah, it is incredible that there are people out there that want to help. And it's about, you know, people getting as many voices and eyes on companies like yours and Matty that's doing these things so that, you know, more and more people can be helped and it can be normalized, you know. One of the things you touched on there, which is quite interesting, is I think most of the time people blame ego. They blame ego for not mentioning it, man, woman, whatever it is, you know, female, male. And they say, oh, it's because they don't want to admit they've got an issue. I think that is a big factor. I'm not disputing that. I think the biggest one, really, though, the reason why people don't reach out is what you touched on in the terms of they don't want to get pulled out of the game. Mm. I think that is bigger. That might be included in ego, if you like. But I know from personal experience that it's not necessarily that you're like, you don't want to admit you've got an issue. You haven't got a problem admitting you've got an issue. If you don't know something, most people from my background will hold their hands up saying, mate, I don't know that. I don't know how to do that. Teach me. I'll try my best. If I do it, I do it. If not, we can outsource. We can get someone else to do it because obviously that's not my forte. So they're not opposed to admitting they've got a weakness. What they're opposed to is not doing what they've signed up to do, not doing their duty, not being there for their lads and their lasses, not being there for their mates. And the idea of I was chatting to a mate of mine, ex-Royal Marine, who's a police officer right now. He's going through some investigatory issues, shall we say, and it should all be cleared up very soon and he should be moving on with his career, but currently it means he has to be, you know, held behind and essentially sitting around when others go out on calls. And he was describing a very frustrating situation where he knew he could help his mates, he knew he could help the situation and diffuse it quicker than some of the more junior colleagues. And obviously he's not allowed to go, you know, he's not allowed to help. He's just has to sit there listening to the radio messages and things like that. And it's that whole not being able to be with that team if you go and ask for help. And I think that's the biggest restrictor to people putting their hand up and say, I'm struggling a bit here, is because they think they're going to be stopped from doing their job.
Mate, absolutely. Spot on. And as you said, there's so many reasons why that can be a really undesirable outcome. You know, it's a hard one. You know, like, it's easy to sit here and say why things are wrong. It's not so easy to say what the solution is. It's a hard one to solve. Mm-hmm. You know, because in some cases, you know, these people do need intervention that would require that. Not in all cases, but in some cases they do. So you can't blame them for saying that ahead of time and then not opening their mouth. So how do you solve that so that you create an environment where people who are really reliant on that particular team or culture or viable role to still open up and share with their employer, because that's what we're talking about here, aren't we? We're talking about employers,
organization. Exactly.
Like, how do you provide an environment where they feel safe and supported to do that, but they're not risking losing the one thing that's keeping them going? And, you know, a big part of that, which is a whole nother podcast, is, you know, identity role fusion. You know, people they've become their role. We all say, I'm a cop, I'm a fiery, I'm this, I'm that. You know, you spend years and years fusing with that identity role, which flows onto transition. That's why so many military members struggle when they get out, because they're no longer that identity role. that fusion that's mm-hmm. taken place, you've just had it. It's gone now. How do you function? You know, so the you know, when that gets threatened, that's one of the many reasons why people don't want to speak up. So I don't think there is one quick answer, and I don't know what it is. It's a really hard one to solve. Who knows what the future holds for those organizations and how they deal with it. But
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's there's a reason why we're not paid the megabucks to make these decisions, I guess. But I think a very important one that often gets overlooked is seeing mental health as an injury, not a disease. I think that's a very important one. A lot of people see it as if you get diagnosed with something, that's you for life, that's you sorted. Even especially from a establishment point of view, if you get marked with, say, PTSD from the military standpoint, your career's almost definitely over. You're gone. And forget about trying to be a police officer in an armed establishment, especially, and any role that could cause any sort of stress whatsoever, not happening. And I think it's important to sort of remember or treat any mental sort of illness, if you like, disorder, whatever you want to call it, as an injury. You know, it's something that can be sorted. You know, it's not sort of preventable. It is it's not as easy as that, it's not as clean as that. There's many different levels and aspects of mental issues that are triggered by different things, and it's not as simple as that. I fully admit that, but I think if we see it more as an injury that can be sorted, then people are more likely to go, well, all right, I'll go get some physio for it then. And the physio for this is counseling, you know, or if counseling doesn't help you, if talking doesn't help you, because it doesn't help everyone talking about the issue, you find the thing that does. You know, it's whacking golf balls down a range as hard as you can. It's practicing jujitsu. It's going go-kart racing, you know, whatever your thing is to help you process that issue. It's meditating, it's yoga, it's working out, whatever it is. As soon as you realize that it's not a disease, it's not really an illness, it is an injury that you can deal with, process and work through, then I think that's a lot better. And on that one as well, I think, you know, in same as injuries as well, prehab is better than rehab. You know, if you can normalize the fact of people going to, even if it's companies like yourself and brands like yourself, and utilizing that counseling pool and saying, look, I don't want to top myself right now, but I am struggling. You know, something's not right. I'm going to have to go have a chat with someone. Or it's doing it off your own back, or going through, better yet, going through your service and that being normalized, that you can do that. You can just say, look, I'm having a bit of a rough time. Can I go for a service? You know, just like in the Essex Fire Service, you can have 5 physio sessions for any single injury whenever you want. You say, I've got an injury, gets assessed. You have 5 physio sessions over the course of a period. If you need longer, they'll extend it for free to help you rehab that injury, to get you back to frontline service as quick as possible. Why is that not a thing with mental health?
You've taken the words out of my mouth, because if you didn't say it, I was going to shortly. 100%, mate. It's the viewing it as an injury, not as a terminal diagnosis of when, if that's you, that's you. It's an injury, and the fact that it needs to be normalized, you know, prehab being better than rehab. If you've got a sore knee and you like running, no one hesitates to go to the physio and go, my knee's sore, can you sort me out so I can get back to running? Like, you know, and my hope and Matt's hope, and it sounds like, you know, your hope, is that at some point that's where we'll get to, which is, you know, I'm aware of the warning signs so I can see them. So I'm going to go and intervene early so mm-hmm. that this injury doesn't get worse. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it would probably stop the injury getting worse, you know, if you can get in there. And the other aspect of that is, like, you know, Matt's mentioned this in a podcast we did together, and I absolutely agree, which is, you know, I would love to see in the station, you know, I'd love to walk past someone and say, like, you know, g'day, mate, where are you off to? Because that's how we talk here. G'day, mate. G'day, mate. and for that person to go, yeah, I'm just going down the hall. I'm just going to go see the counselor for a bit. Be back in a minute. Catch up with you then. Like, for it to be that fucking normal, is what I'd love to see. And I don't think that's impossible at all. I think it's absolutely achievable. The other thing is, it's, you know, how important is their, you know, the mental health of their people? How important is it to these organizations? So what I want to see is, instead of giving someone a referral and saying, sure, we'll cover you and send them on their way, like, I don't know, we're not talking solutions here, but we've got a station with, say, 500 people in it, 400 people in it. If you employ one decent person that is a counsellor or a psychologist or whatever to work in that station and be accessible to the people in that station without the need to, because I've been referred by the organisation and I was 3.5 months waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's that important, then invest and make it accessible straight away, because when people need it, they need it straight away. And have someone employed there, because the people that are off on work cover that are struggling and they've reached breaking point, they can't rock up to work. If you looked at that from a business point of view, and the amount of money that costs, whatever the organization is, versus potentially employing someone on a full-time wage that can intervene, you know, as often as possible when they're actually there in the building and accessible. Like, I can't see how that's not a good investment personally, but it's well above my pay grade.
I think you're right, mate. If you put a business case forward, it's going to greatly outweigh, you know, working in government organizations and being familiar with them. There's a lot of people doing useless roles, you know, get rid of one of them if you have to. There's a lot of them out there. But not going to name any names, otherwise, you know, we're all going to lose our jobs. Perfect, mate. Well, I'm conscious of time and we are ticking on now, and most of my listeners' attention span only lasts about 20 to 30 seconds. So if they last the whole podcast, there is just one thing more about on the policing side, which is quite nice because we can end on a bit more of a less deep topic. Although, you know, it's been fantastic to sort of highlight these things and really delve into the good work that Aussie Frontline's doing. Is one about something that's quite close to my heart, and I don't know how much time you spend on social media. I don't know how many videos you see of police officers taking down suspects or what they view as criminals at the time. But most of my personal experience and most of the things you see online are not complementary to the police officers' techniques in taking down suspects, criminals, whatever you want to call them. And I've been sort of probably out of my experience realm and out of my knowledge overly prescribing to as many people as that would listen, especially within the thin blue line in the police, that they all should train in jiu-jitsu or wrestling, learn how to control someone else's body and put them down to the ground on your own rather than relying on 6 or 7 other coppers. What's your sort of view on it? Do you train it? Do you know people that train it? Is it beneficial? Is it not? What's your perspective of it? I'm preaching to many people as I can with my limited experience of policing, just from viewing it from outside in, that it is the most beneficial thing you can do to keep yourself and colleagues safe, and arguably the people you're arresting safe as well. What's your sort of view on it, really, mate?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends in the police that are heavily into jiu-jitsu. And I have dabbled in it, but I haven't done a lot. I certainly am not one of them. Absolutely beneficial. I think I can speak on behalf of them. If they were here, they would say absolutely, 100%. It would be fantastic if everyone had a baseline level of that sort of skill. I'm sure it would result in less injuries. If your question is, would it be useful? Yeah, absolutely it would. If you want me to go further into it, feel free to ask me some more, but I absolutely think it would be beneficial. We don't get trained. Police don't get any sort of the training that they get in order to, you know, apprehend a resisting offender is at best basic. you know, a lot of the things. I mean, a plan only works until, you know, you're face
to
face with something.
No plan survives first contact, does it?
Yeah, I know you got a saying in the military for that sort of thing, but it's like, yeah, it's all well and good when you've got someone cruising around that's your dummy offender who's not trying to get away with all of their strength, that's not high on drugs, that's not trying to swing at you, spit at you, that's not bleeding from here and there and everywhere else. You know, it's all just theory. And when you're in the situation, you do whatever you can to resolve it. And for most people, mm-hmm. whatever you can doesn't include jiu-jitsu, because I don't do jiu-jitsu. So if they did, they'd have a lot more tools in the tool belt. But that being said, you know, that has its own challenges in terms of, you know, what you've been taught and then what they can rely on in coroner's court. Because if you do something that you haven't learnt through SAPO and you go and take some of your jiu-jitsu that you've learned in private time and then kill someone with that, and then, you know, we all know this sort of stuff gets picked apart in coroner's court 2-3 years mm-hmm. later, you know, being picked apart by lawyers when you had about a millisecond to make a decision. So, you know, we can sort of follow that line all the way back up into why they don't teach you certain things. And yeah, I mean, that's another discussion for another time probably, but yes, it would be beneficial.
Yeah, I think that's it, mate. You know, it comes down to, I think more people should do it. And it comes down to that two lines of, you know, if you do something that's not taught by the service, are you insured and are you protected by the service? The answer is no. It's the same with the fire service, same with the AMBO service, same with the military. If you do something or wear something that isn't issued or provided by the service, or you do something that's not trained and taught by the service, they will hang you out to dry, no matter the service, no matter the circumstances. If they can get away with it, you'll be at fault and not the service. So my always opinion is be as better trained as you can. I'd rather be an unemployed person that's alive because I've lost my job keeping myself and my colleagues alive than being, you know, hurt, injured, or being responsible for the injury of one of my colleagues. However, as I said before, this is my perception from the outside looking in. I've never had to, I've never legally apprehended someone and you know, been permitted to keep them from going where they were going. So, you know, it's a difficult one. I like bringing it up. I like talking about it. I think what we need to do is get police services in the country to recognize that their staffing need to have an advanced level of training that needs to be continuous and not just, right, you learn how to restrain people in training, you know, 12, 13, 14 years ago, get that person down to the ground. I know by 12, 13, 14 years, they're not really doing that role, but, you know, you get the impression. And I think it needs to be normalised and, you know, we need to not rely on private practices to supply this. It's just like the mental health thing. You know, it should be something that's done by the service, provided by the service. And like, right, you know, here's your bi-monthly jiu-jitsu lesson. You don't have to like it. You don't have to do it on the weekends. But here's a way to take people down and control them. These are the approved methods that we like that you should be using. But hey ho, we don't write the checks, I guess, do we?
No, that's right.
Awesome, mate. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Melly. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate. I think we could chat for hours and we could get very deep down many rabbit holes. But in the interest of attention spans, I think it's best to call it quits for the day. Eh?
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you, mate. And I'm sure we will chat again and go down some of those rabbit holes. So I look forward to that. But thanks very much for having me on here, mate, and reaching out. I appreciate any opportunity to spread what we're trying to do. And if that reaches one extra person who can find us and get help or whatnot, then fantastic.
Yeah, mate, appreciate it. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Before we go, if you could just give us your Instagram handles and any sort of links and stuff like that so people can find you. I'll also put it in the description, but if you can just sort of vocalize it for people, that'd be great, please, mate.
Yeah, no worries. So the only place we exist is Instagram at the moment. So it's Aussie_frontline. Pretty easy to spot the logo and whatnot. We are developing a website at the moment, so that'll all come out later. But Instagram's the only place at the moment. Yeah, appreciate anyone and everyone's support for sure.
Perfect. Thanks, brother. Cheers for coming on.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the GTC podcast. Remember, do something that makes you just a little bit better every single day. Don't forget to head over to our Instagram @GTC Podcast. Thanks again. Stay wavy.